April 7th, 1976.
Japanese tonight, a nation known for its ingenuity, and well, it's part of the mysterious inscrutable East, right? And we are part of the mysterious inscrutable West. To the Japanese, we are very inscrutable. Oh, absolutely. I remember one time being in a Japanese department store, and they had this dummy that would greet you as you came in. Yeah, that's right. They had a mechanical dummy. You know, like the kind that Walt Disney has at Disney World? You know, that is a dummy that looks like Abraham Lincoln, or a dummy that looks like George Washington. You ever seen those things? They're fantastic. You know, they're all transistorized, and they move, and they give speeches and all that stuff, and they walk around, and they sign the Declaration of Independence. What are they? A little spooky. But you come into this Japanese store, see, and they got this dummy as you come in. And the dummy stands there and greets you and bows. He's dressed like a floor walker. You know, they used to have floor walkers in department stores with the dark coat with the flower and the lapel, see. And he's got this snappy foulard tie and an elegant white shirt. And he bows as you come in. He goes, Hola, sayonara. He just keeps bowing. And, of course, as the people come charging into the department store, they bow to him. You bow, and he is greeting them. So, inscrutable. I see the day, though, when they're going to have mechanical dummies that work in the complaint department. In fact, I suspect there are some mechanical dummies that work in the complaint department, and you get no further ahead with them than you do with any average mechanical dummy. You complain, the dummy says, "Well, you'll have to fill out the form." And you say, "Well, look at this thing. Look, I got my hand caught in it. I can't get my hand out of it. And this thing is supposed to work. Look, my hand's caught." "Well, you'll have to fill out the form." "But look at my hand. I can't get my hand out. And what am I going to do?" "Well, you'll have to fill out the form." 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 The Stepford Wives are with us. Bum, ba-dum, bum. We also have to salute the Japanese for another thing. You know, the Japanese, a toilet tissue company in Japan, has worked out a fantastic new device for the Japanese to learn English. On every sheet of the toilet tissue that they have in Japan, they have an English word written, and underneath it, its Japanese counterpart. So you can learn the language all the while. Well, would you please? Bring it up. That's it. That's it. Bring it up, Silver. The good folks out there, you know. Lots of doo-doo-doo. Lots of doo-doo-doo. Lots of doo-doo-doo. Lots of doo-doo-doo. Oh, at the Japanese fan. Lot of da-da-da-da-doo. Lot of dee-dee-dee-dee-dee. Lot of da-da-dee-dee-dee-dee. That's stupid. That's terrible. I think the reason that I'm acting like this is very bad. I'm very bad tonight. I'll tell you, I never forget. I was hit by a sudden realization today. I go into the bank, and I go down. You've gone to the bank occasionally, haven't you? Every time you go to the bank, you know these cameras are going. You don't know this. You know, they never say it. The cameras are going all the time. See?
And do you take stances and stuff when you come into a bank so that you look good in the camera? You know, you stand there, you fling your arms out, you walk straight. After all, well, look what one of those bank cameras did to the career of Patty Hearst. I mean, that film, she listen, they got more footage out of that film, for heaven's sakes, than anything Robert Redford ever did. I was on every newscast in the world. And she looked quite good in it. You know, she moved real good in that thing. A little jerky, but she moved okay, you know. And so I'm always careful. When I go into a bank, I make sure that my makeup is, you know, I'm stage makeup. I never go into a bank any longer without putting on decent makeup. And, and I put my shades on, look very cool. Yeah, very cool. And I move good when I go in the bank there. So I went to the bank of this, and I'm walking along there, moving real good, you know, stage moving. I keep giving him my good profile, see, because I suspect I know where the camera is. It's hidden behind the picture of our founder. I go to one of the very few banks of our founder. Well, you know, there's almost every place has a guy called our founder. And I go to one of the very few banks, I think, of any place in the country that's named after a writer. Yeah, named after a writer. You thinking about that? Who is that, huh? Chase? Well, I realized that there was a mystery writer named Isadora M. Ploutworthy Chase who wrote these elegant mysteries in England, but that's not the one I'm talking about. I know. What bank is named after a writer here in New York? That's correct. Of course, you got it right. I'm sorry, Ronnie, you're right. Irving. And the writer, of course, was Seymour Irving, who was a columnist for the Village Voice back in its early days. He wrote a thing called The Village Lout. No, it was The Village Square. What was it? No. All right, who was the writer? Washington Irving. And Washington Irving was known for creating what character? Right. The Headless Horseman. The Headless Horseman. And, yeah, did you see the stamp they had about the Headless Horseman? They had a great stamp here a couple of months back of the Headless Horseman riding through the night with the moon standing up above him. I mean, you know, I suspect that we're going to have a stamp eventually commemorating King Kong. You know, great characters. Why not? That would be a great stamp. A King Kong stamp. How about a Tarzan stamp? You know, Tarzan with his head on the foot of a, you know, standing there with his foot there, planted on the head of a lion, beating his chest, hollering what Tarzan did. In fact, that was a big thing when I was a kid. Kids always worked on their Tarzan yell. Did you ever work on a Tarzan yell, Ronnie? How are you at it? Yeah, lousy, that's right. But, oh, ow, ow, ow. Well, now, you see, the Tarzan yell also was, you realize, in the original Tarzan stories, for those of you who never read Tarzan but only saw him in the movies, you must realize that Tarzan was very different from the way he was presented in the movies. I'm talking about the book Tarzan. First of all, that yell that Tarzan gave was always a yell of victory and warning to all the other creatures of the jungle that Tarzan, the man animal, after all, he was part man, part animal, or he'd been raised by what? Tarzan had been raised in the jungle by what? As a baby. Apes, correct. And he was, I mean, he didn't even know what man was like, you know, he didn't know any mankind. And he was, he had all the strength of the giant gorillas, you see, he was tremendous. And Tarzan, when he was fighting, for example, with one of the great passages, I will quote, Tarzan stood over his fallen foe as the great lion breathed its last. And as the lion expired in the hot, fetid jungle, as the great killer beast slowly died, you'll give me a little echo chamber on this if you can. I'll give you the cue for it. Tarzan placed his foot on the dying lion's head. He flung his head back, and the dreaded ape-man's cry, the cry of victory, and the primal cry, warning all the other beasts of the jungle that Tarzan, the ape-man, had killed again, rang out. The jungle fell silent as the echoing sound of the immense victory cry of Tarzan the Ape Man rang out, and the jungle knew that the killer had killed again. Then Tarzan the Ape Man took a stone knife from its scabbard, and as the jungle fell quiet, he ate of the still quivering flesh of his fallen foe. Did you know that that was from the original Tarzan? Yes, I'm not inventing it, buddy. Tarzan was something else. All right, I'll ask you another question then, if you're a Tarzan freak. Tarzan, who was Tarzan's father? That's very important to the Tarzan stories. He had a father. His father and his mother, and how did Tarzan come to be in the jungle? You think he was just there? Oh no! See, this is all part of the culture of our time. You should know about this. And you see the thing that Tarzan did when he gave out that scream. He struck primal fear into the heart of his fellow jungle creatures. See, Tarzan didn't even know he was a man, you know. Tarzan didn't know this. He was raised by apes. He was part of the jungle. And who was the first human being that Tarzan actually saw? It was not Jane. I'll give you that clue. You know, me, Tarzan, you, Jane. No way. See, you thought you knew so much, didn't you? Oh, ignorance, thy name is WOR, New York. All right, okay. Now listen, now this is a very serious time here. I mean, sorry I told you all about Tarzan there. You used to think Tarzan was just a guy that, you know, could swim and wrestle with alligators. Oh no, something else. A very serious moment here in the show. For the last couple of weeks, I've been playing colleges all over, and I just played MIT. Oh, yeah, that's a official school, I'll tell you. And I had a great show. It's the first time I've ever really let it all hang out and told jokes about Lissajou figures and conic sections. I have a wonderful, obscene story about quadratic equations. It's terrific. And, you know, it was a great night. And all these kids, you know, it's all engineers and stuff there. And after the show, we all went out and went to this place where they all hang out. MIT has a place called 20 Chimneys. And we all sat around and ate the scientifically designed cheeseburgers. They were designed with, you know as well as I do that half the time when you get a cheeseburger, you pick it up and it's too fat to bite. Or when you tilt it, it drips down and it runs down into your elbow. And your brand new suit from Barney's, you know, and the whole scene. So these kids, of course, being engineers, they have scientifically designed. I have seen the cheeseburger of the future. And it works. So for those of you who have given up on the future of mankind, there's a lot of stuff brewing at MIT. I have seen the cheeseburger of the future, and it works. There was one other kid, too. You know, he worked out. He was the first engineer I ever seen that worked with practical things. You know, when you take a box of cereal or something, and it has this little dotted line around the top, and there's a little thing that's a dotted line about the thumb, and it says, press in here and pull back tab, and how it never works. And first of all, you press it in, the whole box crushes on the top. Then finally, you mess around, and finally you get so mad, you just go, aah! You just tear off the top of the box, and you suspect that other people are actually doing it right. Well, he has devised a package that actually opens when you press the tab. Now, he's keeping it under wraps. So I would like to suggest that the future does work. Now, for those of you who are engineers, and I have always felt that mankind divides itself off into the various categories, almost from birth, and they're very subtle, and they're much more complex than even Freud would have imagined. For example, there are the people from birth, practically, and nobody knows why. They'll grow up in a family where nobody else is like that, has a technical mind from birth. There's certain kids that say they wonder how a doorbell works. Now, there are other kids who just not only couldn't care less, but, you know, they hardly ever use the doorbell. They just kick the door. And I can't explain how I got to be that kind. But from the time I was a little kid, I was into that stuff. I really was. My kid brother, no interest whatsoever. No interest whatsoever. I'm very proud to say that I was one of the first kids in our neighborhood to burn a hole in the living room rug with a Gilbert chemistry kit set. Absolutely. And doing experiments that were not in the book. You know, they give you this little book with the chemistry set. You get chemistry set number 12. The one where you can make salt, or you can make this, you make all these various, you know, you can change blue water into orange, titration, you know, and you take a litmus paper and dip it in, and you run these experiments. Well, I went beyond the book, and the next thing you know, the rug is on fire. However, I never stopped from that time on. I can't help it. I'm a gadget type. I look at an electronic clock. My hands itch. The Heathkit syndrome. I mean, it takes a certain imagination on the part of a guy to want to build his own color television set. You know, it's with associated videotape recording facilities. It comes with a Chinese modern plastic bar, the whole thing. And of course, he could just as easy go down and buy it, see, but he wants to build it. And the exciting one is when he plugs it in. And then after the fire department is left, and you know, everybody's calmed down. Oh, these are exciting moments. And I would like to salute a guy. Now, when I was a kid, I used to sit in the back, for example. I remember. Did you ever remember sitting in class when you were a kid and you'd hear something said by a teacher And you would say to yourself, well, then why don't they do such and so? Well, I'll give you an example. I had this teacher who taught science. You ever have a science teacher when you were a kid? Science. That's eighth grade, right? So there was this teacher named Miss Bailey who taught science. And, you know, she looked like, I'll tell you who she looked like. A little bit like Mrs. Bunker, of Archie Bunker. She was a nice lady. And Mrs. Bailey taught science. And we had this science workbook. It was a blue book. And it had stuff like gravity. There'd be a whole chapter on gravity. Then there would be a chapter on chemistry, the world of chemistry. And, of course, it had a periodic table and it discussed the elements. And, you know, very simple science. And so one day, Mrs. Bailey was up there, and she was one of these nice ladies, you know. She says, I don't know how the hell she ever got to be a science teacher. She was totally unscientific. But there she was, nice lady. So she had jiggling jowls. And so one day, she's up there in front, see, and she says, we were in the chemistry section. Now, this was in just a one-semester course, and we covered the whole world of science in one semester, you know, just sort of thing. So she says, now, boys and girls, you all know that when you burn, say, a piece of wood, and the piece of wood is burning, this is called oxidation, and the oxygen in the air combines, and the flames burn up the wood. Now, merely what we are doing is changing one form of energy into another. And we have heat, and we have various forms of gases that arise from the burning. Now, after the burning is over, all that is left, actually, we've not lost anything, because it's all gone into various different forms of energy. And what is left is what we call the ash. Now, ashes, of course, are the parts of the wood, or whatever it is that the oxidation is taking place on, that do not burn and are the residue, but nevertheless, they can be weighed, and it's all part of the same piece of original wood. Now those, I'm sitting back there hearing this, see. Shepherd's great eighth grade scientific aha discovery. Suddenly hit me, whoa. If you have this stuff left over from burning, see, and it won't burn. Like if you burn a bone, see, there's certain stuff left over that will not burn. Why not take that stuff and make fireproof bricks out of it? It's already, you can't burn. Well, I've always felt, you know, if I got the right backing one day, now I realize that most kids don't think about that stuff. They just sit there, have no scientific interest at all, no curiosity whatsoever. And it always intrigues me how the most exciting things around you, most people have absolutely no interest. For example, you're listening to me on a radio. I would venture to say 90% of the people have no interest, nor even the faintest knowledge of how the hell that thing works. How is it that you can hear my voice out of this little bitty box that you paid $12 for? I would say the average man walking around 6th Avenue today, if you walked out and just stopped the average, out of 1,000 people, the average man has about as much scientific information, true scientific knowledge in his head, as a man of roughly the late 16th century. Would you agree with that or not? And yet he has all his stuff around him, see, but he doesn't know a damn thing about it. Most guys couldn't tell you how a light bulb works. Why does a light bulb give off light? Well, because you screw it in, huh? You turn on the electricity, right? Well, see, no interest whatsoever. And people, when you ask people these things, they just sort of look at you like, well, who cares about this? And that is beyond me. I mean, the average person does not know why an airplane flies. What keeps an airplane up? Okay. All right, I'll give you another one. Why does a car go? Well, you said it was because of a motor in it. Well, wait a minute. What makes the motor work? In other words, does the average person have any concept of what the internal combustion is? And for that reason, of course, we can have all kinds of charlatans come around, because most of us have no knowledge whatsoever of science. And charlatans can take advantage of this, of course. And since the average man is both, on one hand, impressed by science, he's also afraid of it. See, man is always afraid of anything he doesn't understand. Fear comes from not understanding. And so the average guy's really scared, you know, they're going to put this atomic power plant, we're all going to blow up. He has no, he confuses atomic power plants with atomic bombs. That's like confusing your radio, because it's got electricity in it, with electric chairs. But this is easy enough when you don't know any. You know, it's grasping constantly. And I would like to salute a guy tonight. You know, you heard about the Guinness Book of Records. And, you know, almost everything in the Guinness Book of Records is kind of stupid, you know, like who could eat the most prunes in one given hour? Takes no talent to do that, just a big trap. And, you know, an endless supply of prunes. And then there'll be a Guinness Book of Records. The guy that can jump up and down on 1 foot the longest. You know, really stupid. But did you know that there is a Guinness Book of Records that a guy is going for that takes real talent? Real engineering talent. For those of you who are into engineering, I want you to listen to this. A Michigan man is shooting for a place in the Guinness Book of Records. Some guy out in Michigan. And listen to what he's doing. If you have got something heavy that you want lifted, Dixon Smith, who is an engineer, by the way, is the guy that's got it. Smith is an engineer, lives in Muskegon, Michigan, and he has invented, now listen carefully to this, don't turn off and say, oh, this is dull, I'm not going to listen. Listen to what he's done. He's invented a contraption that will move anything in the world, or out of it, for that matter. Smith says that his device can lift the weight of the earth 729 billion times over. Did you hear what I just said? He's invented the thing that can lift the greatest weight. No, he's not crazy. No way. No way. Oh, no. Listen carefully to what he's done. Smith, see, that's the person who doesn't have any knowledge of engineering would say, oh, that's crazy. Not so. No way. Smith says his device can lift the earth 729 billion times over. Unlike the ancient Greek mathematician Archimedes, you remember Archimedes' famous line, give me a place to stand, and I'll move the earth. All Smith needs is a 120-volt electrical outlet. That's for the power of the electric clock motor that runs his machine. Smith designed and built this steel and plexiglass contraption in his home workshop. He worked on it for about 10 years using $70 worth of materials. And it consists of 35 simple gears, some springs, and a motor. Now listen carefully. Smith says that his invention has no useful purpose whatsoever, but he believes it could easily get him into the Guinness Book of Records. Because there is a, if you have a Guinness Book of Records, look this up. The slowest moving designed mechanism in the world, and it's in the book, is a clock in the town hall of Copenhagen, Denmark. That's the slowest moving mechanism in the world currently. It takes 25,700 years for the celestial pole motion of the clock to complete a full circle. 25,000 years to go in a circle. And that's a clock that's in Denmark, right? Smith says this is child's play. His gadget will set two world records right from the start. Quote, it is the slowest moving design mechanism, and it's got more torque than any other instrument in the world. Now, here's what happens. The first gear, see, he's got a motor in there. The first gear revolves at 3,000 RPM, 3,000 revolutions per minute. That's the first gear. And each successive gear moves 15 times slower than the one preceding it. See, they're all gears, right? The 11th gear, then, makes a complete turn every 24 years, Smith says. But listen to this. Gear number 14 revolves once every 73,448 years. That's the 14th gear. What this means is that gear number 35, now get this, this is gear number 35, and he has it in there. It's actually built. That gear will complete a revolution once every 46 octillion centuries. Now, this is all mathematically true. He's not kidding at all. Smith figures that the 25th gear has enough torque to lift the weight of the Earth. That's the 25th gear. And gear 35 has 729 billion times more torque than gear 25. Fantastic part. Now, torque, of course. We're not going to go into a technical description of what torque is. But here's a guy who... Now, that kind of thing would interest, I would say, roughly one person out of give or take, probably 10. I can't imagine Howard Cosell being interested in that. But the idea of designing a machine where a gear revolves once every 40 octillion years, and it is still, you know, it is actually moving. If you took a very, very slow motion micro photograph of the gear, you could actually see that it was in fact moving. But it would have to be a very, very speeded up slow-mo type of photography, and you could actually see it moving. And this is totally useless. But it's just like, almost everything else we do. I mean, let's face it. What is Roy White's batting average worth? I mean, isn't that fairly useless? What is Tom Seaver's ERA? Isn't that fairly useless in the cosmic scheme of things? I mean, what president we elect or don't elect this year in the cosmic scheme of things that will be totally meaningless? Can you imagine 5,000 years from now people worrying about who was elected in the year 1976? Or even if there's an America 5,000 years from now. Or even a North American continent, for that matter. And the great waters wash. But that gear will slowly be moving. At 5,000 years from now, do you realize that gear will have barely moved a millimeter? Useless, right? But after all, I have a friend who collects bird whistles on tape. Oh, yes, he's got a very rare woodpecker that he collected in a Jersey swamp on tape. Sounds like somebody dropping a book off an end table. He listens to it hour after hour. I know another person who loves Baskin-Robbins pumpkin ice cream cones. I know another guy who tried to eat all the Slim Jims in Newark, New Jersey one night. Didn't quite make it. Because, you see, he was washing each one down with one finger of Jim Beam. Got pretty exciting around about 3 in the morning. Each man does his best, right, Ronnie? This is WOR New York. Stay tuned for In Conversation, will you?